Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do we know our own minds? Are we able to truly assess the qualities of other people fairly and accurately? Well aware of the ill effects of sexism, racism, ageism, and other forms of discrimination, many of us assume that our desire to create a society free of widespread prejudice is proof of our personal tolerance. But as my guest today has demonstrated over decades of clinical research, it is possible for us to mean to believe and do what's right and still hold implicit biases that our conscious minds find deeply disturbing. Mahzarin R. Banaji is Richard Clark Cabot Professor of Social Ethics in the Department of Psychology at Harvard. Her new book, co-authored by her longtime research collaborator Anthony Greenwald, is called Blind Spot: Hidden Biases of Good People. Mahzarin, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
What are implicit associations?
Implicit associations are simply the pairings of two things. So if two things keep appearing together in our experience, so a word like bread and butter or king and queen, our minds very quickly learn to put them together. And we show that, like that, that there are certain associations that we have to groups of people. In some cases, those are just good or bad qualities that we might associate with certain groups over others. In other cases, they're associations that take on the form of what we might call stereotypes, except that these are unconsciously held stereotypes. We might believe some people are strong and others are weak, some people are smart, some groups are smart and others are less smart, and so on. So implicit associations are nothing more than pairings of group with an attribute.
So why might we have evolved to form these associations, given that, at least when they take the form of stereotyping, they seem to be responsible for so much misery in the world?
Well, you know, these stereotypes are a way in which the human mind thinks, and our brains evolved many, many millions of years ago to be the current brain that we have. And in that old world, it mattered that all we needed to do was to worry about surviving to the next day. And part of survival required that we look at other people and decide very quickly whether they're our friend or our foe. And we use simple rules to make those decisions. Our ancestors would have used simple rules like, do they make the same grunting noises we do? And if they did, then they were our friends. But if their grunting sounds were different, then they were not our friends. And in the old world where, as I said, the demand to just live to the next day was paramount, that worked fine. Now, when we see somebody who's quite different from us, we have to ask a very different set of questions. We have to ask the question, hey, do I want to outsource to this group of people and make some money in my business, or can I collaborate with them to produce something that they and I can do together that neither of us can do alone, in part because of our different orientations and different backgrounds? And so the demand for us is very different today than it was before.
So tell us about this test that was developed to spot these implicit associations in people who do not necessarily believe themselves to harbor any particular biases.
Right. First of all, I should say those are the people we write about are people like myself. So I don't put myself outside the fray of those who are well-intentioned but may not necessarily be the good people that they think that they are. And the test called the implicit association test works in a very simple way. The easiest way to explain how it might work is to imagine having a deck of cards that you're holding. And imagine if I said to you, Chris, just sort these cards so that you put all the black-colored cards to the left and the red-colored cards to the right. If I asked you to do that, it would take you about 20 seconds to sort that whole deck of cards, and it would be a very easy thing for you to do. Mm-hmm. But if I said, let's shuffle those cards again, and now I want you to put spades and diamonds to the left and clubs and hearts to the right, and I asked you to do the same thing, it would take you closer to 40 seconds to do that, because you no longer have the simple rule of all the reds or all the blacks. That's really what the IAT depends on. The assumption here is that if in our minds we associate male with strong and female with weak, then if I asked you to sort cards where all the male faces and words that mean strong things are put together and female and weak have to be sorted together, we would do that really easily. But if I said to you, do the opposite, you know, associate words that mean, you know, strong things in the world, like muscle and power and status and so on, with female faces and weak things with male, that would take me a whole lot longer to do. And that would tell me that in my old brain, strength is more strongly associated with male than female. And you can generalize from this to all sorts of different things that the IAT can test. How quickly can we associate good things in the world with white and black faces? How quickly can we do that with bad things in the world? And so on and so forth. The test is really measuring how rapidly can we put certain things together and how many mistakes do we make as we go about doing that as a measure of how much those things have come to be associated in our minds.
So there are a number of versions of the test that one can take online. We've added some of these to our website or put links up. I actually took three of them myself, and I'm gonna tell you the results here, and maybe you can help me interpret. Mm-hmm. I took one about racial preference, one on the association of weapons with race, and one on sex roles.
Uh-huh.
I did not have a clear preference for either African-American or European children. The test did show I had a slight association between European-Americans and weapons,
mm-hmm.
and the one that disturbed me the most is that I seem to be more likely to associate men with careers and women with housework, which I have to tell you, Mazarine, does not reflect my family life. It does not reflect my worldview. What's going on there?
Yeah. Well, first of all, if I were you, I would be very pleased with your race test results because you are in that minority of people who do not show preference one way or the other. And that's just not true for most people. 70% of white Americans associate white with good and black with bad. I am not white. I am an Asian person of Indian origin, and I show that bias. I associate white with good and black with bad, even though that is absolutely not my intention, and I'm horrified by the fact that the test shows that. But let's jump to the sex roles one. This is a test for your listeners, in which you're asked to associate names of men and women with words that come from two domains, both good, the domain of home and the domain of work. And most of us, even working women, end up associating career-related words with male names more rapidly than with women. And in part, I think it's just hard for working women to associate male with home. Even working women do not really have the experience of having men in the home who they associate more strongly with housework. And so it is a test that is actually intriguing because I show like you. In fact, I'm quite sure my bias is even stronger than yours because this is a bias that actually is predicted by the age of the person taking the test. The older you are, the more you show this bias.
Hmm.
The younger you are, the less you show it, suggesting to us at least that this is a test where as the world is changing and more women are entering the workforce, that we will get better and better at knowing that these associations of female and work are just as natural as male and career are. But in the meantime, we have to deal with the sad sort of fact that our minds can contain sort of thumbprints of the culture, and we are all likely to be susceptible to them.
It's interesting that you're a person of Asian heritage, and yet you have the sort of implicit association of white with good and black with
mm-hmm.
bad, which
mm-hmm.
I take it as pretty mild. But I mean, how much are the test results likely to vary when a person taking this sort of black-white dichotomy test is neither black nor white?
Yeah. So the test result shows that Asians and whites are equal in the strength of association between white and good, that Hispanics are a little less biased, and then, of course, African-Americans are the least, but the African-American test is the test that results that come from African-Americans who take it is actually quite interesting. So let's just back up a little bit. We know that 70% of whites show a white preference. If the world were sort of an even place, then 70% of African Americans should be expected to show black preference. But that's not what we see. Hmm. What we actually see is that something like 40% of black Americans show black preference, and 40% of black Americans show white preference, and about 20% show no preference one way or the other, which is intriguing because it tells us that not all groups show an equal degree of positive association with their own groups, that many of our minds have come to learn which is the really good group. And black Americans in this culture at least know that their group isn't the one that is associated with good things, and that has come to be in their own minds.
Now, I did notice that when I took the test on race, and then the version of the test that I took, just to explain to people, was there's faces of children, and you can identify them as either European-American or African-American, and then there are these words, either positive or negative, and you match them up. The first round was European-American children and good words, you match those up, and African-American and bad, and then when you switch it, it goes the other direction. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in results if you first challenge people to say African-American children with good words and European-American children with bad words?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the test has a particular order in which it's taken, mm-hmm. and there are things that we call order effects. That is to say, the order in which you take the test may produce an overall effect, such that if you take the European-American and good first, that might show a slightly greater European good preference. But in all of our studies, we make sure that half the people who take the test take it in one order and the other half in the other order. In fact, when you went to the website and you took those tests, you were given a randomly chosen order. So now there are some over 14 million tests that have been taken, and about half of them would have been in one order and the other half would have been in the other order.
And what happens if people take the same test multiple times?
Yeah, and many people do. There are many people who take a test, you know, six or more times because they're interested in why this might be the case, whether they can beat the test. All of these are wonderful ways to approach the test. By taking the test a few different times, you're not likely to change the test result too much, but I think of the IAT very much like a blood pressure machine. You know, when you strap that little gizmo on your wrist and it spits out a couple of numbers, a lot of things influence it, how you hold your hand, whether, you know, your elbow is higher than your chest or lower. So there are some variations on the test, but I actually think that just as we want to get a good sample to learn about anything and whether it's a reliable result, with the IAT too, I would say taking it six times and then taking the average of that as the indicator of what your actual implicit attitudes might be is a good idea. Now, if you take the test hundreds of thousands of times, then you might actually learn how you can beat the test.
Well, hopefully people would rather spend their time examining their own behavior than just trying to beat the test.
Exactly. And I think your show, the name of your show, is what they need to do. They need to think.
We're speaking this hour with Mahzarin R. Banaji. She is Richard Clark Cabot Professor of Social Ethics in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. Her new book, Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People, is co-authored by her longtime research partner, Anthony Greenwald. We'll come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mahzarin Arbanaji. She's Richard Clark Cabot Professor of Social Ethics in the Department of Psychology at Harvard and co-author, along with her longtime research collaborator Anthony Greenwald, of the new book Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think at kera.org. So, Mahzarin, you noted that at least as regards our attitudes about sex roles and gender roles, age is a factor in deciding how people will finish. Would the results on, say, race have likely been different if we were to give them to Americans 75 years ago?
That's an excellent question, because although we didn't have this test to give to Americans 75 years ago, when we look at age differences today, when we look at kids taking the test who are 10-year-olds and 70-year-olds, we see on the race test no effect of age. And this surprises many parents who say, look, I know that my kids think very differently about race than I did or my parents did, and yet on the IAT, the association of black with bad and white with good is robust across age. And I think that that may be because our racial lives are still pretty segregated. I think that while much has changed, we really have very few friends who that across race lines. And we live in neighborhoods that are segregated. We go to schools that are segregated. And so, you know, in retrospect, I guess I'm not surprised to see that six-year-olds show the same race bias on the IAT as do adults. And that's actually quite surprising and even striking.
Is it possible to tease out our bias according to race, meaning skin color, as compared with our bias according to race as it results to class and culture?
So, you know, in our tests, we kind of put them all together. Mm-hmm. But you can make tests up that actually hold, let's say, skin color to be constant. You can make sure. In fact, the test at the website that you took held the skin color of the people you see to be constant. You may not have noticed that, but our black and white faces are grayscale images that don't really vary in skin color. They vary in features. And so, of course, there are many different components to all of this, but I actually do think that the world around, there is a negative association to dark over light, and that, I think, is indeed part of what is being picked up. But we cannot separate out all of the things that go with being dark and light. There are obviously differences of culture and so on, and those are currently all encapsulated in the category black and white.
There are also really a lot of people make very negative associations based on age.
That test shows some of the most negative associations. So close to, I think, 80 or 85% of Americans associate elderly with bad and young with good. And this is another test that is interesting to us because the elderly show about the same level of anti-elderly bias as do young people, showing us again how much our culture has made that association a strong one for us, such that even people who are members of that group end up showing those biases themselves against their group.
Does that happen also in places where the elderly are more likely to be revered as sort of wise and prized members of a community?
So there are age differences. We now have, I think, something like 30-plus countries in which we've set up these tests so that they are specific to different countries and in over 22 different languages. And so we do have data on the age test from a variety of different countries. And, you know, they vary. In India, the association of elderly with bad is weaker than it is, say, in Germany. But it is not a simple east-west kind of difference. It turns out that in countries where the number of elderly proportional to the number of young people is large, that attitudes towards the elderly are more negative on the IAT. And so, but in every country that we've seen, including in India and China, the overall association is more negative with elderly. In no country have we seen a positive association of elderly. That is to say, elderly and good being stronger than elderly and bad.
We're talking to Mahzarin Banaji about her new book, Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Ray in Dallas. Hello, Ray.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What a timely and important subject. My question for your guest this afternoon is involves social construction. Meaning, how is it that we come to have these ideas? And when I talk with a lot of persons, I'm a person of color, and when I talk to a lot of friends and colleagues and students who are Anglo, and they really consider themselves to be good people, but they don't understand the privilege in which they have because their group, whatever that group is, whether it be young or male or heterosexual or white, that they are privileged because of the social construction of that group being good versus of another group being bad. So if our guest could talk a little bit about social construction and the privilege that comes along with it, and how did we get here?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Ray. That's not only a great question, but so articulately phrased. I will, first of all, I think privilege is invisible. Most people who have privileges can't notice them. That's sort of in the nature of the way in which our minds work. And I think that what you said about social construction is important because when, you know, in a sense, when a baby is born, it doesn't know these things. This is stuff that the baby absorbs from the outside culture. So in that sense, we have to know, and we do know, that these are completely socially constructed. On the other hand, what we've been surprised by is just how rapidly both young children and even adults learn these. You know, I think if an immigrant from some other country shows up in New York City knowing nothing about the United States, I bet that in a day they would learn that there's something about South Asians and newspaper stands that go together. There's something about Koreans and grocery stores, and there's something about tall white men who hold briefcases walking into tall buildings. They would learn these associations very, very rapidly, which tells us that, yes, indeed, they're socially constructed, but our minds are wired and ready to learn these associations because we somehow believe that they are very important for us to know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line we have, I think it's Ngozi in Dallas. Hi, Ngozi.
Yes, my comment is as someone that immigrated from another country into this country and grew up through different institutions and interacted with people from different backgrounds and races, no matter what your perceptions are, it helps a lot to interact, you know, and step outside of your comfort zone. And people usually come in with their own perceptions already of which race is supposed to be good and which race is supposed to be bad. But once you start opening up people, opening up the different groups and meeting different people in different settings, you understand that everyone has something special and something good to offer. And it actually really helps with the ethics and socialization, and it really makes it easier for you to understand people and relate better. You know, it just makes for a better understanding.
Yeah, those are really interesting points, Ngozi. Thank you so much. Do they have an impact, Mahzarin, on the way we might respond to these tests?
You know, when people say to me, what can I do? I say to them, get a passport. And that's exactly what Ngozi is talking about. Mm-hmm. And a very, very small number of Americans have a passport or have traveled abroad. The reason, I mean, I'm not saying that that's going to wipe out bias by any means, but it begins to sort of show us that the strict categories in our minds may not always hold. And still, you know, I was just teaching a class the other day, and Somebody in class just said, he said, I know this is going to sound bad, but I have to say, I hate all Serbians. And I just said, are you serious that you want to say that? And he said, yes. And I don't know what experiences he's had. I can't, you know, say that what he's saying is completely uncalled for. But you and I know that there's absolutely no place in our modern world for a statement like that.
Right.
And I think that's the kind of thing that probably eases as we travel and as we realize that these fixed ways in which we thought things happened in other countries or in other groups of people simply aren't that fixed, that they are more flexible. And I think that kind of understanding, and also to know by sort of being the foreigner somewhere else and having, you know, a lot of Americans have said to me that when they go abroad and they go to China and they do not speak a word of Mandarin, that's the first time they recognize what it must have been, you know, for the Hispanic person in this country or for the foreigner in this country who did not speak a word of English, because they realize that they sound dumb in mm-hmm. China. They're not any dumber in China than they are here, but they sound that way. And I think that is an important recognition.
Well, talk about this, if you would. When you mentioned your student saying, you know, he feels he hates all Serbians, it's a lot of people worry that no one makes statements like this anymore, which is a good thing, but that people simply have learned that it's inappropriate to make those statements and not necessarily that it's inappropriate to harbor those feelings.
Right. So that's a very unusual kind of comment to hear. We just don't hear that anymore.
Right.
In fact, one of the interesting experiments has been that since the 1930s, social psychologists have been measuring conscious stereotypes. They went around asking people in different parts of the country, tell us, what do you think about Italians? You know, what do you think about Jews? What do you think about the Chinese, the Japanese, and so on? And in the 1930s, people would say things. The Chinese are superstitious. You know, the Italians are dirty and lazy. You know, things like that. And the good thing about this study is that every 15 years or so, another group of research scientists have gone back to some of the same places and asked some of the same questions. And what we see is tremendous change. And mm-hmm. and I think, you know, for people who believe that we're not changing at all, these data are actually going to be contradictory, because they show that Americans have changed dramatically. But for people like myself, the question is, okay, we've stopped saying those things, but is it possible that they still lie inside our minds in some way with a lid on them? But the lid can be taken off quite easily. I was myself kind of surprised in the aftermath of the Bernie Madoff event, when people began to realize that Bernie Madoff, and he had done this horrible thing of taking the money of many, many nonprofit groups and individuals and had run this Ponzi scheme and lost all their money. And when that happened, I was actually surprised at the degree of anti-Semitism I even heard amongst sort of liberals on the East Coast.
Mm.
And it struck me that perhaps these stereotypes about Jews actually haven't vanished, that they might still be in our minds as they were in the minds of, you know, people in Elizabethan England, in their characterization of somebody like Shylock in Merchant of Venice, and that characterization is not entirely gone. It's there. It may be in a slightly weaker form, but it's there so that when an event like Bernie Madoff happens, suddenly people feel it's okay to be able to say those sorts of things.
Hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Scott in Fort Worth. Hi, Scott.
Well, good afternoon. I would pronounce your guest's name, but I'm afraid that I'll mispronounce him. I don't want to do so.
That's perfectly fine, Scott. Thank you for having a simple name.
Well, I've enjoyed your discussion very much. You made a comment, however, that I found a little bit concerning, and I asked if you would clarify. You stated that people oftentimes take your test and then discover that they were not the, quote, good, unquote, person they thought that they were. And my question is, given the reality, some of the social realities that we find, that we know certain cultures, certain groups are much more likely to be incarcerated for violent crime, etc. Given the fact that those are the realities of the world that we live in, until those realities change, how can we say that someone is not a good person when subconsciously their preferences may indicate those realities? That's my question.
It's exactly the question I asked myself many years ago when I first began to do this work. our minds. You know, we're not idiots. We walk around the universe just sort of absorbing things that we really see out there. And to some extent, what we have in our minds is indeed representing nothing more than the reality of what is out there. I would say that the best way to think about these tests is to ask the question, how would you wish to be? So a lot of people will say, I do not want to associate the qualities devil, bomb, war, vomit, awful with Black Americans any more than I want to associate them with white Americans. I would like my mind to be able to exert the kind of control such that no matter what the culture has taught me, I, the individual person, Mazarine Banaji or Scott, we each want to believe that no matter what's out there, that we ought to be able to control in some way what's in our minds. What this test does is it says, look, our minds are made up of so much stuff that we do not have conscious access to. And that stuff really is a repository of very much what you're saying, what's out there in the culture, and not even what's accurately out there in the culture. We just did a study in which we asked people, how many Black Americans are incarcerated? How many white Americans are incarcerated? How many Black people are mayors of cities? And how many white? And we find that people are actually quite wrong in their estimates. We are not very good at knowing these things. So the first thing to tell you, the first thing I would say is that we like to think that we accurately represent those facts and figures that exist in the world outside. They're often not very accurate. And the second thing, and this is the most important issue, it's that I really think that the test is a measure of where do my conscious values sit versus what's in my mind. So, you know, if your test result shows an association of Black with bad and white with good, and you're cool with that, then there is nothing to be said about it. We're actually not interested in trying to tell people that there's something in their minds. If they say, look, I can see what's in my mind, and I know it's a reflection of the culture, and I'm happy with that. We've become interested because the millions of people who've come to the website have expressed many emotions. You know, we have people who say, I'm fine with what I just saw, but most people don't say that. They say, you know, I know that that's out there in the culture, but I don't want that in my own mind. And when I discover it in my mind, then there is reason to be unhappy. Then I say, and I say this routinely, I am not the good person I think I am, because in my own mind, these things have come to be lodged, even though I don't want them there.
Let me just
say,
we have to take
really believe in
quick
in
break.
Willpower.
Quick break here. Mazarine Banaji is my guest, and her new book is called Blind Spot. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Clark Cabot, professor of social ethics in the Department of Psychology at Harvard, Mazarine R. Banaji. Her new book, written with her longtime research partner Anthony Greenwald, is called Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Mazarine, for the people who take these tests and find one or all of the results to be different from what they want, what can we do? Do we look really carefully at our own behaviors and sort of just double check ourselves for acting on biases?
Got right to the point, Chris. You know, it's possible that I could have these implicit biases in my mind, but let's say I don't let them influence my behavior. That would be fine. Mm-hmm. Our worry is that that's not what happens if we remain unaware of them. So, you know, if I don't know that I have hypertension, I will go about leading my life in a very different way. I might not cut down on my salt intake. I might not do all those kinds of healthy things that I need to do in order to address this particular disease that I might have. And likewise, I think with the mind, just as with the body, that if we are not aware, then there will be very little that we can even think to do in order to change our behavior. So behavior is really the gold standard. You know, and many people I've talked to have said, you know, I don't care what's in my mind as long as it doesn't influence my behavior. And I think that that's a wise thing to say. The difficulty is that it does influence our behavior because we can't control all aspects of how do you, you know, do you smile at elderly people when you see them on the street? How close do you sit next to somebody who's from a different group as opposed to somebody from your own group? All of those little micro behaviors end up being the stuff of social interaction. They're what lead us to hire people, you know, to privilege certain people's work over others, for doctors to treat their patients in different ways, for judges and lawyers to make, you know, more or less of a case for somebody or the other. These behaviors, we think, are likely to be influenced by our implicit attitudes and stereotypes unless we become aware of them.
So I got myself into sort of a vortex thinking about all this with regard to, say, employment practices. Because if I were in a position to hire someone, I would ideally find someone who didn't hold any of these implicit biases that we're talking about. But having admitted that I have some and that you have some, I mean, is there any danger that these tests could be used in a way that would ironically cause us to be biased against certain individuals regardless of their demonstrated behaviors?
So, as you said, because we carry them, I have no doubt that my biases are influencing the people that I hire in my own lab. And what do I do? I mean, what I can do, if I believe that I am somebody who is able to understand evidence, to take that evidence into account, and to change my behavior, I have to sit down and look, first of all, at my past behavior. Mm. I have to look at who did I hire. The last 9 times that I could hire somebody, who did I hire? What did that person look like? And was there diversity in the kind of people that I hired? And the reason I ask that question is not because I want to be good, but because I want to be smart. I need to make sure that Harvard University brings in the very best people from around the world to contribute to the doing of research, to contribute to teaching, and so on. To the extent that my biases lead me to not pick the best person, the extent to which my biases get in the way of my picking the right person is a problem. I often give my students an example. I show them a picture of Microsoft Corporation in 1978. If you saw a picture of Microsoft Corporation in 1978, it was a group of about 12 of them. They look like a motley crew. You know, they have these big sideburns, longish hair, flower shirts, and they just do not look like the kind of people who could achieve anything at all. And I give the example that, indeed, the CEO of Encyclopedia Britannica turned them down. He said, I don't think you have a good enough idea of how to, you know, do this. They were suggesting that the Encyclopedia Britannica be put into software, that it go online. And they were turned down by the CEO of Encyclopedia Britannica, and that was a mistake. The mistake was that he wasn't able to get beyond the way they looked and to see what real talent there was in that group. And I think we do that every day, most of us. But again, you know, vigilance is can take us very far. By just being suspicious of your own ability to recognize talent, you can make a better decision.
I think all of that is great information. Where I was actually leading with the question was, your HR department at Harvard gives you this battery of tests and says, oh, Mazarine, I'm sorry, we can't hire you because this reflects an implicit bias.
Oh, I see what you're saying, like kind of a lie detector test or
right,
something.
Right.
Oh, so we, Tony Greenwald and I, have said very, very clearly that we are completely opposed to any such use of the test,
mm-hmm.
because we just don't think that that's a good use of the test. This test is not like a DNA test. You know, a DNA test is conclusive. A DNA test, it can give you an answer that is a black and white answer as to whether the DNA that you're looking at comes from person A or person B. I think that this test is not like that. It is more like a lie detector test, which has a lot of variation. And so we don't think that this test has any place in the selection context. And we've said that explicitly at the website where you went to take the test. We say very clearly, and to our knowledge, nobody has used the test. In fact, if somebody did use the test to make decisions about who to hire, we would be willing to step in and challenge that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Adam in Dallas. Hi, Adam.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was, you had mentioned these cultural biases are given to us by society, and I was wondering if you had done the test on any perhaps genetic biases. And the thought that I came up with, the first example that might be associating bad with foods that are putrid and rotten, and good with foods that are tasty and healthy. I was wondering if you had looked at anything like that.
So I'm not sure I heard your question exactly. I think you were asking if there are certain sort of genetic predispositions and whether this test would pick those up. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so it absolutely does in certain ways. But here's an interesting one that I'll tell you. So meat eating and vegetarianism. There are certain things in our world that we know are just good, and vegetables are good. And even those of us who are meat eaters will show a preference for vegetables over meat on the IAT, right? So it is. So in that sense, yes. But yeah, but I do think so. I think certain things that evoke old kind of fashioned disgust in us, yes, this test will very easily pick those up.
What happens, what can you learn if you test, say, if you associate good words with baseballs and bad words with basketballs? Can you learn anything about the sort of patterns that the test might take when the subject being tested is sort of not fraught socially?
Yeah, so we do many tests of that kind. What you see at the website are the tests, as you describe, socially fraught. They're social group tests. But we can make many, so in the clinical domain, actually, people have been very interested in these. You know, there are people who suffer from phobias of certain kinds. There are people who have anxiety, you know, when they think about things like getting to work and so on, or the fear of the outdoors and so on. One way in which the test has been used very effectively is to measure in a treatment program whether somebody is actually improving. So, you know, I could be somebody who's scared of snakes and I'm trying to get rid of that phobia, and I could say to my therapist, I think I've now overcome my snake phobia, but have I really? Well, I could take an IAT. I could take a test in which I could see the degree to which I'm associating, you know, snakes to good and bad things. And if my results look like that of the general population, which is to say snakes are not good, but they're certainly not as bad as they were in me, then yes, we can start to use these tests to measure just about anything. Marketers of products are interested in using them. You know, I might say I like this brand or that brand, but which one do I really like? We can take a look at that. Also, political attitudes. So we've been doing these studies during the last three political elections in measuring early, for example, even in the primaries, do your implicit attitudes for candidate A over candidate B match what you say you prefer? And, you know, by the time an election comes around, if I say I prefer candidate A over candidate B, then my test result will also show that. But maybe early in the process, when I don't yet know, or if I'm one of those people called independents who say, we haven't made up our mind. Well, my colleague Brian Nosek did studies to show that independents may say that they're independent, but on the IAT, they certainly have a preference for one over the other candidate.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Forrest in Fort Worth. Hi, Forrest.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is about possibly the relation of political correctness to biases. I think we can all agree that with maybe more offensive biases, we tend not to express opinions that we might have formed based off of those. I'm wondering, does that make it more difficult to identify the ways in which we're biased when we are a little bit more uptight with self-expression of our opinions? And what's an easier way so that we can go about identifying these biases and correct them?
You know, in some ways, this kind of test makes you be politically quite incorrect in one sense, right? Because here I am. I'm saying, you know, my mind seems to include all these things that I'd never thought about that I now have to fess up. I have to say, I can't walk away from the fact that in my mind, female and home are more strongly associated than female and career. That's a scary thing for me because I'm a working woman. I do not want to have that association in my mind. So I think one of the things the test does is that it just takes that whole political correctness issue out of this equation. It says, look, there's, you know, if those things are in our minds, we can't hide from them. And, you know, I will say that there are liberals of a certain generation who do believe that it's other people who are biased, not they. And what this test does is demystifies that a little bit, because it shows that even in those very liberals who say that they don't have these biases, they might exist. And in that sense, I think it just attacks this political correctness question in a very different kind of way by making it clear that almost all of us are not as correct as we might think.
Why do you think that we don't recognize many of these within ourselves? I mean, there may be individuals who say, yes, this reflects the way I feel about the world, and this is what the test says. But, you know, for you and for me, a surprise to find that we associate women and home and men and careers. Why doesn't that register in our conscious minds?
It's a very, very exciting kind of question, because it gets at the heart of how much we can know our minds. You know, if I said to you, Chris, right now, tell me, what is your pancreas doing right now? I mean, you would say to me, Mazarine, I have no clue. And you wouldn't be outraged if you didn't know what your pancreas is doing. But if I said to you, you know, you don't even know what's in your own mind, that's a little unsettling. We think that we know what's in our minds, mm-hmm. because as humans, we have this incredible quality, an advantage called conscious awareness. We can look into our own minds and see what's there in a way that no other species can do. And that gives us, I think, the false belief that we can look into all of our minds and we know all of it, when in fact what we actually know is probably a very thin sliver of our minds.
So beyond traveling, beyond experiencing different cultures, people of different backgrounds, what else can we do to broaden ourselves so that, if not our own generation, maybe the next will have fewer of these implicit biases?
Hmm. So I practice something that I call the think the opposite rule. Hmm. And initially it's not so easy to do, but as soon as something happens, if you have to think the opposite of it, if you have to think about somebody different, so the UPS guy jumps out of his van and delivers a package, you can imagine somebody very different jumping out of the UPS van. Because, you know, it's still true. Very few women drive UPS vans. And you can start to think the opposite. So I have something that I call my intervention, which is a screensaver. I have the sad life that I look at a computer screen for many more hours a day than I look at any human being. And since this computer screen is my closest companion, I figured I could use it to give my mind information that I want it to have, not what the culture normally just gives it. Hmm. So I have a bunch of pictures that I've scanned in that are pictures that capture oppositional things in the world. That is to say, you know, I have a picture, for example, of a woman who is a construction worker. She is wearing a hard hat, and she has her big heavy boots and her jeans on, and she is breastfeeding a baby on her lunch break. Hmm. Now, I think that this picture, as simple as it is, pulls apart the way my mind thinks in so many different directions, away from the way the culture has trained it up to think, that my hope is that what I'm doing is just stretching.
And we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time, unfortunately. Mazarine Banaji's new book is called Blind Spot: Hidden Biases of Good People. Mazarine, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produced the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. And I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.